more forcefully than Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I just like to say maybe some blue people will call you up.
Maybe so. Yeah. Just as long as they don't use blue language on the air, we'll be fine.
Right, fine.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Nice to chat with you, sir.
Likewise. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Okay.
And then Christmas is coming, don't forget.
Oh, well, yeah, we're only 300 and...
Six, the sixth.
Oh, that's 12th night. 12th night is on the 6th.
Huh?
12th night.
Well, yeah, I always thought it was January 6th.
It is January 6th.
Yeah,
it's 12th.
Right.
That is the 12th night.
Yeah,
you
right,
start from December 25th, you count off 12 days, that is the 12th night.
Those who celebrate Little Christmas out there, Merry Christmas or Little Christmas.
Okay, very good.
Okie doke.
Take care.
Take
Thanks
care.
For calling. Bye-bye. Telephone number here at WBAI is 917-580-6020. My name is Jim Freund, and this is 1 minute from Hour of the Wolf. And good morning. You are on the radio.
Morning, James.
Good morning, Robert.
I saw The Hobbit twice. Before that, I took your advice. I was going to reread it anyway. I saw it in Britain, and I saw it in California. By the way, for the gentleman who's interested, the Smurfs are Belgian. They come from the Flemish area of Belgium, loosely based on a forest sprite whose name I haven't tracked down yet, but they're very similar to Cornish piskies or pixies.
Okay.
Yeah, that and, you know, there was a Prince Valiant movie. It was... Well, it was one of those movies you want to watch at 1 in the morning.
Well, as that person said, actually, the idea of remaking a Prince Valiant for the 21st century might be a cool idea.
It could be. Now, did you notice a couple of things about The Hobbit? One of the things that I noticed very rapidly, and thank God I had a friend in California who gave me a great running translation, because there was a lot more orcish, elvish, and dwarfish spoken in it.
Yes, thank you for that, and thank you for having more music.
Yes.
And more of the culture in The Hobbit than they did in all of The Lord of the Rings.
According to her.
I'm sorry?
Maps. You said that you wanted maps.
There's a little bit of mapping in this, not a lot. In Lord of the Rings, in the extended edition, not in the normal edition, you see maps very briefly. And
really?
In this, they show the one Tolkien map from the hardcover edition of The Hobbit,
right.
And they show it about four or five times. And here I have a question for you that maybe you can answer.
Okay.
Several times on the map, they give a location. Tolkien gave a location called the Desolation of Smaug, which, by the way, will be the name of the second film.
Really? Thank you.
Now, I must have misinterpreted it, because my assumption was that desolation meant that this is where Smaug was destroyed. But that hasn't happened yet in the movie, so how can it be on the map? So desolation must mean something different than I think.
Yeah, I think it does. I don't know if it means the desolation of Smaug after he destroyed the dwarfish entity under the mountain, or whatever, because I didn't know that it was the desolation of Smaug. But if it is, it can't be.
Well, that's the title from the chapter in the book, and that's on the map in the book, and they point to it. And since that map is the map that is shown in the movie, you see the words two or three times.
Yeah, I have a feeling it really refers to what happened after he took over of the Misty Mountain or Lonely Mountain, whatever it is. Did you notice, or did you think that the movie was fast-paced? The one thing that I noticed from 2 hours and 45 minutes was it went off by awfully quick.
It does go fairly quickly, because there is almost always story happening. It is never sitting still, but what it is moving with, there is so much in there that is just totally extraneous and has no business being in the movie at all. If you get rid of the 10-minute sequence with Radagast, there is one very, very, very good reason to have that whole thing with Radagast. And the answer is that who wouldn't want to hire Sylvester McCoy? I suspect that Peter Jackson is of an age that when he was watching Doctor Who, Sylvester McCoy was his doctor, and so he had to put him in there. Now, Radagast does appear in Lord of the Rings in the novel, but never in the movie. He does not appear except by passing reference, just like Saruman,
right,
in The Hobbit. And yet we have a lot of Saruman and we have a lot of Radagast, and there's no reason for it.
And we're and we're also going to get, because you saw the foretaste, somewhat of Sauron, because he is the necromancer at Dol Guldur.
Now, I've always had that question. A, is he the necromancer?
Yes, he is. Let me tell you why. A friend of mine...
And B, when you answer this, please include this, because I always get confused. Okay. Define for me the difference between the necromancer, Sauron, and the Witch King.
The Witch King of Angmar was the leader of the Nazgul. Angmar was...
Because that's who I thought we saw in the movie.
Yeah, the Witch King, he's mentioned specifically, the Witch King of Angmar is the head of the ring race. He has one of the nine rings. He was seduced by Sauron. He has one of the nine rings, and he destroyed the northern kingdom of Arnor. Remember, Gondor's in the south. Arnor was up north. Arnor was destroyed, according to the appendix, in 1979, Second Age. That was when Arnor fell. It meant that the only bastion of the free men of the West was down south in Gondor. Angmar then was he supposedly destroyed himself, but apparently somehow he was revived, and then he becomes the... Because he is mentioned in The Lord of the Rings, especially the Two Towers, and especially the Return of the King. One of the things that intrigues me a great deal... It is no accident that Tolkien knew directions. Let me tell you what I mean by that. It is no accident that Gandalf... By the way, something else. A friend of mine, the person who went to see The Hobbit with me in California, told me that the other two members of the Order of Wizards are blue. Their names are Palando and Alatar. She found this out through a board game.
Well, my question for that is, where did the people who created the board game get that from?
I don't know. She was very definite about that, because I always wondered who the other three members of the order were. We're never told in the Lord.
I am willing to accept only two sources, and those sources are John Ronald Rule or Christopher Tolkien. Anything else is fan based.
What I'll do, I will speak to her on a totally different matter this week, and I will get her source. And if it is creditable, I will pay.
It could be credible. It could be in the Silmarillion. It could be in one of the eight so-called lost worlds of Tolkien. But it is not in Lord of the Rings.
No. By the way, of course, the number of rings, of course, nine for the nine mortal kings. Of course,
nine for mortal men doomed to die.
Yeah, the seven for the dwarf lords. Five,
in their halls of stone.
For the elves. By the way, one last thing. You're right about the music. I love the music. Obviously, the next two movies will hopefully have more music, more singing, more poetry, more culture. It is no accident that Tolkien chose the directions that he did. It is no accident that the Valar come from the West, because in Celtic tradition and Celtic mythology, the West are the undying lands. High Brazil, the Isles of the Blessed, Tir na n'Og, the land of every youth.
And that's a term that he uses, Tir na n'Og.
Tir na n'Og means the land of every, the land of youth.
Ah.
Other directions, the east has always been, and again, it's no accident that Mordor is in the east. The east has always been, in popular culture, the land of peril, the yellow peril, you know, Fu Manchu, the popular culture, the Orient, the mystical. So the East has always been that dark area. I mean, they talk about Africa as a dark continent, but in literature, from the oldest times, the East has always been the South and the North. Well, the North, of course, has always been sort of, you know, the forbidding, cold waste. The South has always been. Now, it's interesting that in the South, in The Lord of the Rings, he has the Haradrim, the cruel Southrons.
Right.
By the way, which also proves to me that he knew Hebrew. Look at his names. Haradrim, Rohirrim, I-M is in Hebrew.
Well, I don't know how well he knew the language itself, but he was a scholar of he was a scholar of all languages.
He knew Finnish, he knew Icelandic, he knew He knew the Norse languages.
He was a philologist. This was his calling.
Another translation, by the way, that he did that you're probably familiar with is he did a great translation of Gawain and the Green Knight.
Yes, yes. That is probably considered the definitive translation.
But, you know, listen, on the whole, I would have to say pluses and minuses. I know the bloat is out there. Unnecessary characters. I mean, when you saw the scene in Rivendell with Galadriel and Saruman and Elrond, I said, oh my. And then, of course, you saw, of course, I did enjoy, I will say this.
And I was very, by the way, even though she's not in the book, I was very happy to see Galadriel.
Oh.
Even though she doesn't belong there. She's the Lady of Lorien.
She is. By the way, were you pleased that at least they got the same people to play the same roles in The Hobbit as they did in The Lord? I loved Andy Serkis. I think he's a better Gollum in The Hobbit than he was in Lord of the Rings.
Yes, except for, well, he's also had more years of practice, except for one thing. In my mind's eye, and as a producer of some Tolkiana, and remember reading some of the background about Smeagol, not Smeagol, Smeagol, thank you very much. Well, they say Smeagol in the movies.
I've heard Smeagol.
In the movie, they say Smeagol.
Okay.
Okay? Haven't watched it for 4 days, and I'm talking. Lord.
No. I'll take your word for it.
They say Deagle and Smeagol. And the my imagination, the voice, the thing that he says that he's constantly gulping, which makes a noise like Gollum. So what they, in the movie, what Andy Serkis, who is absolutely amazing and brilliant, and they didn't, and totally deserves an Academy Award nomination, at least for his work in Lord of the Rings, but they wouldn't give it to him because they didn't understand that motion capture is a performance. They thought of it in terms of, oh, he's just doing an animation voice.
Excuse me, what's motion capture?
It's when you capture a person's motion. There's nothing on the screen that Gollum does that Andy Serkis didn't do. Andy Serkis blinks his eyes. Gollum blinks his eyes. They put little white...
Really?
Oh yeah, that's how the creature is created. It's a type of animation. It's commonplace today. John Carter was made doing that to brilliant effect. But motion capture is where they capture the motion, and then it's like a super rotoscoping where they create, in this case, using CGI, they have the dots of like every inch of this person. There's a little white dot, one for each eye, one for the eyelid, one for the eyebrow, one for each finger and all that. And when that person has to act and do everything. Andy Serkis was not sitting in a studio looking at animation and making the voice. Andy Serkis performed the role, and then they animated the character over what he did. That's motion capture.
Can you tell me briefly what rotoscope is?
Rotoscope is a technique developed by the Fleischers in the 20s and still in the silent era, in which they would film an actual person or thing, and then get they would project the picture onto a paper or a screen or a sheet or something, and then they would draw on the sheet. Then you get rid of the picture and all you get rid of the actual photograph or film that originally existed, and what you're left with is only animation, but it's animation of something that was real. It wasn't free drawn by hand. That's rotoscoping.
Let me just say one more thing about voices, about characters. Of all the people in The Hobbit, and of course I noticed this obviously in The Lord of the Rings, I thought that they really hit a grand salami, as they say in Brooklyn, with Christopher Lee as Saruman. I mean, I have heard voices, and voices get to me, but Christopher Lee did a superb performance as Saruman.
And by the way, it may very well be pointed out that Christopher Lee was a huge fan of Lord of the Rings going back to the 70s.
By the way, anyone that does not think that The Lord of the Rings is not about nature versus runaway industrialization or technology, all they need to do is watch the scenes in the Forest of Fanghorn with the Ents when Treebeard points out that many of the trees that he knew had been cut down. And Saruman is, you remember that scene?
But that's almost secondary compared to, and this is the thing that's totally missing from the movie, the scouring of the Shire.
Yes, exactly.
And Tolkien says in that same essay I was reading from earlier that the scouring of the Shire, was, you know, he doesn't have a specific message, but the concept of the scouring of the Shire, Sharky's End as some call it, was one of the very first things in the story in his mind that was always supposed to be there. And it explains it not that necessarily, oh, the technology is here and going to ruin things. It was that never again would people see a bona fide agrarian society where the largest tools to be used might be a rake or a hoe. Instead, tractors were coming in and stuff like that. And he was, it's not so much anti-technology as an homage, an elegy to agrarian England.
Oh, absolutely. Tolkien was not a Luddite.
Right.
He wasn't a Luddite. He was, you know, the Luddites, you know, just basically just wanted to eschew anything. But that whole scene, when you see the Uruk-hai, the great orcs, with the massive armor and the broad shields, and it looks like, to me, it sounds like almost a factory under Isengard. It sounds like an assembly line clanking out Fords from the 20s.
Well, they do that kind of thing, and yeah, I think there's a little hint of Raymond Scott's Powerhouse in there. But I have to say that I did not hold well with Peter Jackson's image of either the orcs or the Uruk-hai. They did not meet my mind's eye image. I thought that they basically looked like people wearing evil costumes. In The Hobbit, he does a far better job, especially with the goblins.
Do the orcs look more orcish than in The Hobbit than in the trilogy?
Yes.
I mean, do they look?
Well,
like
first of all, there are very few orcs in The Hobbit. In fact, if you read the book, the word never appears in The Hobbit.
Goblins.
They're goblins.
That's right.
And they are, and Jackson uses them as a separate race.
By the way, in The Hobbit, do they really look fierce? I mean, do they look like they could?
Well, it depends on the. They're actually individuals, and there's a weird thing that I assume has to come from either the Silmarillion or one of the appendices, where there is a bad guy who's following them all the time. They're being chased in The Hobbit, which God knows is not in the book. Who's called the Pink Orc?
I wonder. I was going to ask you. I don't remember a pale orc.
There is no such thing.
Now,
at least, you know, if there is, it comes out of some obscure appendix. It does not come out of, shall we say, the canon.
Well, I'll tell you what we have in The Hobbit that I do remember. One is the Great Goblin. Now, there are two goblins.
Now he's very well done in the movie.
The Great Goblin?
Yes. He's played by Lee Pace. Who's,
now, is he the, he's killed by either Gandalf or Thorin Oakenshield, right?
He's killed by Thorin, yeah.
Thorin, okay. The other goblin that is mentioned, and you will not see him till movie 3, is Balg of the North.
Right.
Remember when the dwarves the 500 dwarves come to aid Thorin, he's besieged by the elves and the men of Dale, and there's about to be this battle when all of a sudden this bird show up and Gandalf says, Balg of the North has come, because he took over the goblin.
And the Battle of the Five Armies, yeah.
Right. And he, of course, is killed. Well, I don't want to give it away. Nobody will remember this. He's killed, I believe, by Bjorn. I don't think we've met him yet.
I don't know if he's going to be in the movie.
Hey, we got 5.5 hours left of this, and there's got to be more backstory. I mean, we haven't even seen Elrond's brother yet.
He doesn't count for a whole heck of a lot.
No, a lot
of these people are going to be eliminated in much the same manner that Tom Bombadil was eliminated.
Let me ask you a question.
And I wonder if they're going to do Beorn correctly.
I hope so. Anyway, let me ask you one last question. One of the things that we talked about, my friend and I, was, well, we've seen this movie. Did we like it enough to want to wait 2 years? Let me ask you. You're a Tolkieniana. You're as knowledgeable on Tolkien as anybody I've known outside the, you know, outside the circle of scholars. You want to see the next? Do you want? Can you wait? Can you hardly wait to see the other two?
I can wait.
So can I. I mean, I said, I talked to my friend, and she said, you know, well, okay, we have 2 years to wait.
I liked The Hobbit. I would give it 2.5 or 3 stars.
2.5. I would have given it 3.5.
No way.
No more than 3?
No more than 3.
No more than 3.
How would you rate the 3 films of Lord of the Rings?
Oh, I would give the three films.
Do them individually.
Individuals?
Yeah.
The first one I would give about 3.75.
Okay.
The Two Towers I would give a 5.
I wouldn't, but go on.
The Return of the King maybe 4. Because I thought of the 3, the best to me, in terms of the music and the story and the battle sequence. I know that there was more battle in the Battle of Pelennor than in Helm's Deep, but the Two Towers to me was the best of the 3. And it's interesting because before we went to music camp on Thursday, I got to see the extended Two Towers, which I guess has even 20 more minutes. And there was a scene that I didn't remember when Boromir, Faramir, and Denethor are deciding who's going to Rivendell. And there's this whole sort of thing between Boromir and Faramir. And Denethor, of course, Faramir, because he doesn't think much of Faramir. Boromir is his shield. Boromir is his anchor. And Denethor more than hints that if, in fact, they have found the weapon of the enemy, bring it back. We can use it. And remember, Faramir in the 3rd movie says to Denethor, would you have preferred that I would have gone and died in my brother's place? And Denethor says, you're damn right.
Yeah, but that's in all the versions. That's not in the only in the extended.
Oh, I didn't remember.
It was
in
there to begin with, yeah.
Anyway.
But anyway, I would rate them differently.
You would, okay.
I'll agree with Fellowship of the Ring being just shy of a 4. Two Towers, they drag a lot of stuff out that there is no reason, and especially in Two Towers, this whole business where Aragorn goes over a cliff.
Oh, that.
They spend 10 minutes on that, and it's useless. It doesn't add anything to the movie. It doesn't add anything to the story. It doesn't happen in the novel. It's pointless. If you totally cut that sequence out of the movie,
you don't miss anything.
You don't miss anything. Now, right there, that stops it from being a 4.
Okay, so you'd give it less than. What about the Return of the King for you?
Just having sat through the 4-hour and 10 minutes version, that's a 4. That's
even
a 4.
Even with the leaving out of Sharky?
You can't count what's left out. If you're going to do that, then I would give Fellowship of the Ring a 1 because it doesn't have Tom Bombadil,
who's
my favorite character in it.
I'm
rating the films. Hold on. There we go. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, good. I would leave. I am rating the movie on the strength of the movie.
Okay.
I am not rating the movie on what they did or did not include from the book.
Okay,
when
I understand.
So Tom Bombadil, who, as far as I'm concerned, is worth a 2-hour movie on his own, the omission of Tom Bombadil angers me and upsets me. But and saddens me most of all.
More so than Sharky?
No. The whole point of the trilogy is the scouring of the Shire. And I don't call it Sharky. Sharky is a character who never existed.
But the leaving out of that disappointed you more than Bombadil?
Yes.
Oh, okay. No,
for a very simple reason. I've got my phone here and I'm reading Tolkien's text from that. But as I said earlier, Tolkien began writing The Lord of the Rings with that in mind.
Uh-huh.
That's the purpose of the damn novel, the scouring of the Shire. It's the here you are in your nice little home in Oxfordshire. Thank you very much. Here you are in your little home, and it's all going to be basically it's going to change. It will change from technology. It will change from evil people. It will change from war. It will change from this and that. Did he have a message? No. The only message that he really had is an elegy to past times. And that is what is represented in the scouring of the Shire. It does not have to do with Saruman.
You know, the other thing.
Or Wormtongue.
That, of course, to me, and of course, this is another message. Jane Yolen once said to me that consequences actions have consequences, be they good or ill. And remember, as Elrond points out to Aragorn, and by the way, this seems more apparent in the movie than in the book. If I'm wrong, you'll tell me. The strain, more than strain, between Aragorn and Elrond over Arwen. Because Elrond is saying to Arwen, even
that's just created for the movie.
Oh, it was.
Arwen's hardly in the book.
No.
Arwen doesn't exist. And the stuff that Arwen does in the movie is stuff that belonged to Celeborn, or a different character, who's totally cut out of the movie. And I can understand and appreciate why Jackson did it, because there are no women in Tolkien.
Very few.
About
there's
the
Arwen, there's Galadriel,
Arwen
and Eowyn.
Okay, Arwen hardly appears. Okay, let's everybody read the book again and show me where Arwen shows up. Answer: she shows up in time to be married.
Exactly.
That's it. She's gone. She's got nothing to do with anything. Now, you know, you do have Galadriel, and she's a big deal and she's special. Most importantly, you have Goldberry. Why does everybody forget Goldberry?
I don't.
But she's not even in the movie. And then you have Eowyn, and I thought they did Eowyn very, very, very well. Miranda Otis got an Oscar nomination for her role in that, and she deserved it.
Is that who played her in the films?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, Eowyn to me was a no-brainer. Here was a woman that wanted to go riding with a sword and a horse. She didn't want to stick around at home. She was a shield maiden par excellence, sort of like what the Politsiana are in Russia. You know, these women who go riding as like the boyars and the bogatyr and go slaying dragons.
And in the movie, they do refer to her as she says that she wants to be a shield maiden. She uses those exact words. She's not quite Brunhilde because she doesn't she's not a Valkyrie. She doesn't have the powers of a Valkyrie sweeping up, you know, a field and all that. But she has special powers, and she and the moment in the book and the movie when she kills the Witch King is incredible.
Yeah.
But Liv Tyler, you know, she was put in there because they needed some kind of female companionship. P.S. Outside of Galadriel, there is not one woman who has even one spoken line in all of The Hobbit.
You're talking about the movie,
yes.
The book.
Yes, the movie.
Oh, the movie. Either way, I have.
And Galadriel isn't in the book.
Kate Blanchett is absolutely marvelous as Galadriel.
Yes, she is.
She sounds imperial. She really,
Well, one of the best points in Fellowship of the Rings is when Frodo offers her the ring. The most powerful moments of the entire movie trilogy are in the first movie.
Uh-huh. Yeah, doesn't she actually, he offers her the ring and it almost sounds like she, because her voice suddenly takes on a different.
Well, the visual is also very striking.
She transforms. Turn into some monstrosity or to some powerful.
She describes exactly what she turns into. I'm forgetting the exact term. The fairest queen, all will love me and despair. They use the same special effect for her as she imagines and calls out the power that would be if she were the Lord of the Rings, that they use for seeing the ring wraiths and for that matter, seeing Gollum in The Hobbit when Bilbo puts the ring on.
By the way, just this is the last point I want to make. You mentioned Sméagol, Gollum, and I noticed something.
Oh, and I was going to finish that point.
Yeah, go ahead.
That what they have Andy Serkis doing is that occasionally he'll like clear his throat and say Gollum.
Not
as a radio producer, as an audio person, try this out. Gollum. Gollum.
No, the one thing.
Now that's, I believe, what Tolkien had in mind. Gollum.
No, the one thing that I noticed, and I especially this comes out in the Two Towers, and I had noticed this before, that there seems to be almost a war between Gollum and what little of Sméagol may be left. It almost sounds like he's having an argument with himself.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's in Tolkien. That's also in The Hobbit. I mean, he's, well, shall we say, bipolar?
Okay.
But, yeah, the name of the chapter in the book, you may recall, is Stinker and Slinker.
Yes.
And one is always arguing with the other. And one may also there is controversy over the reason why Gollum refers to us. Is he talking to the brother who he murdered, or is he talking to his bipolar self, or is in fact that bipolar self, the good part that is left, the brother that he murdered?
Deagol, I believe his name was.
That's correct. Sméagol and Deagol.
Right. Now, by the way, is it true that, and Frodo refers to him, when he says to Sam, Frodo refers to him as somebody like us. So I'm gathering that originally he was a river.
He's a halfling. Not told exactly what kind of a halfling. He is not a hobbit,
No. But
he is a halfling.
Yeah, because there were divisions. There were Harfoots, there were Stores. There was a couple.
Those are all divisions of Hobbit.
They're divisions of Hobbits, exactly.
But he was not a Hobbit. He's a totally different kind of a halfling.
Well, he's sort of like a third cousin, I guess. Anyway, just one last quick. You're still having the reading next Tuesday night, right?
Yes. Oh, okay. God, I haven't promoted that.
No,
I have to do that.
So we'll see you then.
Okay, very good.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. And yes, that reminds me. Yes, indeed. Are we having a reading on Tuesday, January 8th? Oh, boy, are we ever. And I didn't print it out and bring it with me. But I don't need to do that in order to tell you the wondrous, wonderful things. If you enjoy fantasy and if you're tuned in now and following any of what we're talking about, one assumes that you have a certain caring for fantasy. Then next Tuesday in Soho at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, we will have, I am trying to call it up. Didn't bring my tablet with me, but I do have a phone so I can look it up there. Somebody texted me. Oh, wait a second. Okay. I got a text. Oh, I have to read this to you and then I will go back. Yes. Alatar and Palando are canon, but not as far as I remember, only from notes of Tolkien. The names were working names of the two Maiar, I think it's Maiar, M-A-I-A-R, who came from the west with Radagast and Olorin, were sent by two other Valar, then Manwë and Aule. That's A-U-L-E. They were lost rather quickly, and no further notes of their fate that I know of have been found. At least one is said to wear blue, and both are pictured as wearing blue. This is from any Iron Crown game, which is what I assume was being referred to. As they had to get everything approved by the Tolkien family, I guess they are the names now. Well, the who gets to approve what in Tolkiana is a very difficult thing. But let me continue. All the games follow Tolkien canon closely, and I seriously doubt this was due to the company. Their knowledge was less than I would have liked. At least they looked it up. Okay, that thank you, Lisanne Lake. So, there was a very, very interesting interview with Christopher Tolkien, published in French in Le Monde, about 6 or 7 months ago. And Tolkien sold all the rights to his worlds in about 1972, a fellow by the name of Saul Zaentz, Z-A-E-N-T-Z. He's the one who commissioned the first Lord of the Rings movie by Ralph Bakshi and that god-awful TV version of The Hobbit with Glenn Yarbrough singing the song, the animation by Rankin Bass. There were a lot of problems with the Lord of the Rings movie, but it had a screenplay by Peter S. Beagle, which is, makes it, as far as I'm concerned, very authentic. But there were a lot of problems with the animation, and of course they cut the guy's budget about 9 times in the making of the film, so Bakshi never got to make the movie that he wanted to make. But at any rate, why was I bringing, who has control over what? Christopher Tolkien is the keeper of the flame. He, a lot of the books written for him and to him while he was in World War II, and Tolkien was writing things and sending him letters and stuff like that. It's a great article. I'll put a link to it at ourwolf.com and people can read it for themselves. But he does not get to be the keeper of everything. The most recent thing that the Tolkien family put down was, are you ready? Slot machines. Yes, yes, yes. Lord of the Rings slot machines. They won that one, apparently. But there is also a thrill adventure ride. But they do not have the rights to media. And there are things that are derivative of media that Saul Zaentz can license. And how much Saul Zaentz works with Christopher Tolkien and family, and now Tolkien's son, because Christopher Tolkien is like 87 years old, I'm not sure. I trust what Lisanne says, though. But I do, and I agree with what she said in that email, or text message, actually, that when she says that it probably comes out of an appendix or notes. There is a huge amount of material. When Tolkien died and Christopher Tolkien inherited, he inherited like 800 typewritten and manuscript pages of notes of Tolkien that did not come out of, were not in The Hobbit or Lord of the Rings. And he has been doing this monumental task of trying to put it together. And he said in this article how scared he was of all of the net result. Was he getting it right? He said he had dreams in which his father appeared and started pointing out everything that he got wrong, which the image of which is quite something. And it actually gave me a huge amount of sympathy for Christopher Tolkien, which I never had. But of course, he doesn't give interviews. This is like the only time the man has been interviewed in some 30 years or so. So it really humanized him for me and said a lot. So where do these names come from? Okay, I'm quite willing to concede. And I said at the time, it probably comes out of appendices. So when I say the canon, what is canon and what is not? I guess that's a whole other question. If Tolkien writes a note about somebody, is it canon? I would argue probably not, because Tolkien would revise things constantly. He revised The Hobbit. He wrote The Hobbit in one manner, how Bilbo finds the ring and what he tells Gandalf about it, in one manner in 1937. But when the book came out after The Lord of the Rings was published in the United States, he revised how Bilbo found the ring and what happened during the riddle game in order to retrofit it with The Lord of the Rings. Now, that's okay by me. That's fine. It's not Grebo shot first kind of stuff, but it's okay. So, but which one is canon? Both are by Tolkien. Both are in the book called The Hobbit. Tolkien wrote many notes, many things, most of which he never thought would see the light of day. So I would argue that canon is if it was published in one of 4 books. Lord of the Rings, which is really one book, but, you know, or if you prefer to count it another way, it's 6 books and 3 appendices, and The Hobbit. That, to me, is the canon. There's also then minor things like Farmer Giles of Ham and things like that. The Silmarillion, which was never published, is that canon or not? Well, it's certainly background and certainly tells us Tolkien's intent. And perhaps it is canon. It's hard to say. Where does one draw the line? I certainly know when people talk about the canon of Sherlock Holmes, they're talking about only those stories and novels that were published by Arthur Conan Doyle in the magazines. Now, beyond that, I know people, and so does Lisanne, we know people that speak Elvish, that translate Elvish. I have met any number of them. Robert said that I know Tolkien better than anybody. Hoo-ha! No. When we did the reading of the Council of Elrond in 1972, and the producers were myself, Dave Marks, and Margot Adler. Dave Marks was the on-hand Tolkien fanatic. Searles, Baird Searles, had a slight connection. He knew Tolkien. He gave me Tolkien's phone number, and I spoke to Tolkien to get some pronunciations of names, believe it or not. But Baird knew his stuff, but he was also very much a critic and a knowledgeable man who came to decisions and stuff like that. Dave Marks was, and for all I know, we're friended on Facebook, is a true expert. He could tell you, oh, that's from the third appendix, and in there he says very clearly that the Valar, this and that and the other thing. However, it's very difficult to tell about the Valar if you don't read those appendices, okay? If you're not going to go that extra mile, you may very well not ever get the full concept of what the background of Tolkien's myth and languages are. And since that is the real reason he wrote these books, it's very, very important to know. So, I would like to continue, and I want to take more phone calls, but I also need to take a brief break. I have been sitting in this room yapping at you already for over 90 minutes, and I just want to get some fresh water, take advantage of a couple of things. And then when we come back, I would like to take more phone calls from more people. I see one person is calling. I'm going to ask you just, you know, be patient, wait 5 minutes or so, and we will get, I have to do some searching here. Let me stop that and start that again. I have one very specific song in mind. Here we go. Double click that. It's this computer. Sydney, if you're listening, this computer, well, it has issues. It wants to do its own thing. Okay, R-H-Y-M-E-R. Let me search through that directory. It ought to come up. No, it's not. Okay, files, folders, very good. That folder won't even let me click the search button. I cannot believe that. Okay. Steel Eye, the name of the file. Okay, here's Steel Eye. My God, do we have a whole lot. Ah, here's a version. It's probably a live version. Bah. I thought it was on the 35th anniversary world tour. Ah, but it's not. No, I know where I was getting confused. I know it's on their tour. Do people know what I'm talking about? In Australia. Gone to Australia. It is, of course, Steel I Span. The name of the song is, of course, Thomas the Rhymer. The music is by Steel I Span. That is to say, Matty Pryor and Tim Hart and Peter Knight and Robert Johnson and Nigel Pigram and all that. But the lyrics for this version of Thomas the Rhymer are by, J.R.R. Tolkien. And then we'll be back. I should qualify that and say not the lyrics, the translation.
Oh, along, come along, Thomas Arima.
I prefer the studio version of that song, but that one also has the extended lyrics, and it was the one that I was able to find right now. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifico Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. My name is Jim Freund. This is Hour of the Wolves, and we are discussing Tolkien and the various media adaptations of Tolkien and, of course, the original, where it stands, what it does, and all of that good stuff. Now, I was going to, I have an event this coming Tuesday, and I have sorrowfully neglected it because I was planning on going on at 1:30, my normal time when I came in. Sydney Smith said, why don't you go on earlier? Because there was no recording here for Robert Knight. And I thought, okay, it's freeform. I can do it. And then I, running hyper. But that for me, those who know me, that's nothing new. This coming Tuesday, January 8th, at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, we will present Terry McGarry and Veronica Shaness, two wonderful, wonderful writers and people all knowledgeable in so many different things, fantasy. We were going to have them in October. Things screwed up. I won't get into it. But let me just tell you a little bit about them. Terry McGarry is the author of the Tor fantasy novels Illumination, The Binder's World, and Triad, and has published short fiction in more than 40 genre magazines and anthologies, which include Amazing Stories, Aboriginal SF, Realms of Fantasy, H.P. Lovecraft Magazine of Horror, Live Without Net, and Alien. Her genre poetry is collected in the award-winning chapbook Imprinting from, now I'm going to get it wrong, Amanesis Press. She has been a freelance copy editor since 1987, specializing in science fiction and fantasy, and worked at The New Yorker for 15 years. Last of them as The Page OKer. Okay, now that's like, top of the field, The New Yorker, okay? You have a typo in The New Yorker. Well, that means Terry McGarry wasn't working there at the time. A New York City native, she has also been a bartender on Wall Street, an English major at Princeton, and a street trader in Ireland. She holds a third-level belt in Krav Maga, and so be gentle when you come to the meeting, and plays Irish traditional music at gigs and pub sessions in New York and on Long Island, where she currently lives. She only got her power back about 3 weeks ago. I am not kidding you. Veronica Shaness, who was on this program, just about a month ago, along with Genevieve Valentine. Veronica is an assistant professor in the Department of English at Queen's College, CUNY, where she specializes in children's literature and speculative fiction. She's also particularly interested in women's writing. Her academic publications include such intriguing topics as Fearless Children and Fabulous Monsters, Lewis Carroll, Angela Carter, and Beastly Girls. That's one long title there from a publication called Marvels and Tales. Book as Mirror, Mirror as Book, The Significance of the Looking Glass in Contemporary Revisions of Fairy Tales, from the Journal of the Fantastic and the Arts. Her short fiction has appeared in publications such as Strange Horizons and Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet. She has a story forthcoming in Ellen Datlow and Terry Windling's Queen Victoria's Book of Spells, sort of steampunk fantasy. Steam wand, maybe. Steam magic wand. Something like that. Steampunk magic wand. Whatever. These are wonderful people, wonderful writers, and oh so knowledgeable. And, hey, the admission is free. We do ask for donations at the door, but that's just to help cover some costs. Admission is free, bottom line. You pay nothing to get in. You'll have a great time. That's Tuesday. This coming Tuesday, we'll open the doors at 6:30. We generally begin reading at about 7 o'clock, but you are most welcome to come at 6:30. We will have cider and cheese and crackers and stuff, and you get to meet people, and a good time will be had. Afterwards, we all go to a nearby pub, and you get to meet more people. Or the same people for longer. This is at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, which is located at 138 Sullivan Street. That is between Houston and Prince Street. And it's pretty easy to get to. And a good time will be had by all. And I hope that you will be one of the all who will attend. For more information, you can't go to my website yet. I haven't put the damn thing up. Tomorrow, within 24 hours, you can go to OurWolf.com, OurWolf.com, and get all the information. Actually, if you go there and click on the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, you will get the schedule of what we've had and what we will be having. But these bios and all of the, and certainly it will have maps on how to get there, but the particulars on next Tuesday's reading won't be there until tomorrow afternoon. So I hope to see you there then. This is one in which the readers are not necessarily the big star names. They are simply some of the best writers around, period. So, take that. The telephone number here at WBAI is, I almost said the wrong number because it changed, 917-580-6020. 917-580-6020. I wonder if that's going to be our new semi-permanent number as we move the station all the way uptown. Who knows? We don't have phones here still at 120 Wall Street, but in a month we won't be at 120 Wall Street, so we shall see. And good morning. You are on the radio. Hi there.
Oh, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks. Excellent show.
Thank you.
So, I read The Hobbit, I guess, a little earlier than you did, maybe, 65, 66. I can't quite remember. But I still have the paperback from back then.
Ah, yes, the Ballantine.
It says the authorized edition. I think that was a big deal back then.
I'll explain it. Before, that's Lord of the Rings. Before,
well, this is The Hobbit.
Okay, but that was then probably published after Lord of the Rings was first illegally published in the U.S. But the U.S. did not subscribe to the same international burn copyright laws as we do today. So the copyright laws in England were different than they are in the U.S. And Ace Books put out an edition of Lord of the Rings without permission. They had lovely covers by Jack Gaughan, one of the best, that's G-A-U-G-H-N, one of the best artists of all. And after a little discussion between lawyers, Ace took the books off the stand. Tolkien sold properly the rights to all of his books to Ballantine Books, to Ian and Betty Ballantine. And that's why, so there were unauthorized editions.
Mm-hmm. This is Houghton Mifflin?
No, we're talking paperback here.
This is a paperback, Houghton Mifflin, Ballantine Books. Yes, okay, that's Ballantine Books is.
Ballantine Books at the time was independent, I believe.
Oh, well, it says right on the cover, Houghton Mifflin, and inside it says Ballantine Books.
Ah, okay, Houghton Mifflin certainly did all of the American hardcover editions, and they were authorized. My copies are Allen and Unwin, which were the, I have the British editions.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. Well, this paperback does have a couple of maps. And it does have the Desolation of Smaug.
Right.
With a dragon.
Yeah.
And
that is the map that appears in the movie.
I'm taking your advice and rereading the Hobbit after 40-some-odd years, more than 45, so before seeing the movie. But on the Desolation of Smaug, Smaug is in the far northeast on this map, east of Mirkwood.
Yeah.
I mean, the Desolation of Smaug.
Right.
And So it seems that you were questioning what that means?
Yeah, because I am a little bit confused there. Because if the desolation of smog is I always assumed, and I'm probably wrong, but I always assumed that that meant it was the destruction of the dragon. But that couldn't very well be on the map before the dragon is destroyed.
Well, I'm not up to this part yet, but I opened to the chapter Inside Information. If I may read a short passage, maybe it sheds some light on what that is.
Okay.
Because it says here, darkness grew deeper, and he, meaning Bilbo, grew ever more uneasy. Shut the door, he begged them. I fear that dragon in my marrow. I like the silence falling to the uproar of last night. Shut the door before it is too late. Something in his voice gave the dwarves an uncomfortable feeling. Slowly Thorin shook off his dreams, and getting up, he kicked away the stone that was the door. Then they thrust upon it, and it closed with a snap and a clang. No trace of keyhole was there left on the inside. They were shut in the mountain, and not a moment too soon. They had hardly gone any distance before down the tunnel, when a blow smote the side of the mountain like the crash of a battering ram made of forest oaks and swung by giants. So Smaug attacked, and he desolated the countryside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he desolated the countryside long before the dwarves ever came back to the Lonely Mountain, I guess. Mm-hmm. So that's what you. So you're saying that that's what it really refers to is Smaug's killing all the dwarves and humans that lived in the area.
Yeah, but other than those that had shut themselves in the mountain.
Right. So yeah. Okay. So that does make sense. That then would explain my question.
Okay. Okay. So just wanted to suggest that.
No, it sounds right. It makes all the sense. It's just that, ever since I first read it as a kid, I always made an assumption that the desolation of Smaug was like the destruction of Smaug rather than the place that Smaug had destroyed.
Okay. Okay. All right. Great show.
Okay. Thanks so much.
I'll just listen.
Okay. Take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye. And hold on 1 second. I need to apparently close doors because there are people out there. And that just makes way too much noise because I can hear every word you're saying on the air. But that's all right. All righty, we're back now, having closed doors and sadly chastise people. I shouldn't have done that. Hey, Lister, how are you doing? You're permitted, but... Okay, so let's see, what are we doing? We're taking phone calls at area code 917-580-6020, and there were calls when I left, but not now. Okay, here they are. Good morning, you're on the air.
I wasn't going to call back, but let me just correct something I said about you. I said that you know Tolkieniana as well as anyone I know outside the parameters of scholars and academics.
So I'm not a scholar?
Well, I'm using it in,
No, I'm not a scholar.
No. Some people... let me put it to you this way. I was on an airplane last week, and I was talking to a stewardess. I'm sorry, I'm as PC as next, but they're stewardesses. Forget in-flight cabin attendants. And she was amazed, for reasons that you know, that I was able to tell her 98% of the film. And we talked, and she said, "Are you a scholar?" I said, "No, I taught high school for 40 years ago. I was for 20. I'm retired now." She says, "Well, you're a scholar." No. I mean it in this full complimentary sense of the term, that you know Tolkieniana as well as anyone I know outside of the academics. I know a few people who, John Boardman, he's a scholar. He knew stuff that he.
And there's a person who I don't know about now, but years ago, you could hand him a text and he would hand it back to you in Elvish.
I'm not surprised. By the way, one last thing. I hope someday that somebody. See, I come at Tolkien from several points of view. I come at the appendices to me are just glorious. I wallowed in them, I read them over and over again. for the history, for the chronology, for the gazetteer. That's a fancy term. You know, Tolkien was a master gazetteer producer. He gave you the world of Middle Earth, and he gave you, like you say, the poetry, the culture, the music, the languages, the history. I would love somebody. It won't be me. But I would love somebody to do. Somebody said to me, would you like to do a book on the folkloristics of Tolkien? I would jump at it because there is so much in there.
There have been, and it's funny how actually after the movies and the media versions start being done, there was a time when there were chapbooks galore. One of my favorite of all times was a book that was just examining funeral customs, burial and funeral customs in Middle Earth.
Wow.
I mean, and that's a whole book. And if you think about it, every time one of the important characters in the book dies, they get a different kind of funeral.
I always remember when Theoden's son, Theodred, second ward of the Riddermark, dies, and you see him, and Eowyn says, "Your son is dead," and he sits there, and of course you hear the things.
He's buried in the family tomb, which is under the throne.
Under the throne,
he joins his ancestors there.
And Gandalf, it was either Gandalf or Aragorn, said he has gone to join, to be in the hall of your father.
Exactly. Yes.
And I believe there was also, was there not a funeral for Theoden when he dies after the Battle of the Pelennor? I believe there was.
I don't recall. There has to be, of course. But one assumes that it's the same kind of funeral and action that was given his son. But of course, they're on the battlefield and they're going from one battle to another at that point. So exactly how that was done,
there was even a funeral for Denethor. I don't want to say he was bad. But Denethor, obviously he wanted to kill Faramir.
Well, he is holding his own funeral, and that's a funeral by fire. It's on a funeral pyre, and that is the Gondor way for the Stuarts. He assumed,
almost like a Viking ritual.
And then, of course, let's deal with Boromir, who gets put into a boat.
Yes.
And the boat is sent down. It's not burned, as they tell in some other traditions. In his case, his boat is just sent to float down the river, which includes, by the way, in that particular story, a waterfall.
That's right. Yes, you're absolutely right.
And that's Boromir's particular ending. And then there is, of course, the questioning of whether it's a funeral or what, as everybody finally goes to Greyhaven and heads for the west.
One of the things,
and that has great ceremony to it as well.
And one of the things,
and that's just one chapbook out of 30.
Wow, there were 30 funeral. I'm going to have to look.
No, not 30 on the funerals. I'm saying
no,
that.
No, 30 chapbooks.
There are many, every fan, every professional writer I can name. If I were to name the authors of some of these people, I will not, because it could be that these were, shall we say, not properly licensed. Which might explain why once the stuff started hitting the media, these stopped coming out. But if I were to name the people, they would include, somebody who's the author of a major series on HBO.
Uh-huh.
And,
yes.
But Jack Chalker, had his own press, Mirage Press, and he put out a fabulous, and I've no doubt initially not properly licensed, book of an atlas of Middle Earth.
You mean complete atlas?
Yes.
Showing everything.
Yes, showing everything, including Western lands and Western all lands. Different kinds of things, maps of within the Misty Mountains. It was an entire book. That was a bestseller for him. And when we say for him, remember, this is a small press. There were probably 500 copies, although that book was eventually codified. And they changed a lot of the artwork, I'm sorry to say. And there was a version put out, I think, by Ballantine Books. And by the way, do people out there listening remember the annual event of loads of Tolkien calendars?
There was
a time when the big question was on a given year, not just who won the Hugo Award, who won the Nebula Award, who's doing this year's Tolkien calendar?
Well, I'll tell you, like I say, there's so many. I didn't realize that there were all these chapbooks.
Oh, yeah.
One on funerals intrigues me a great deal. One last thing about this. And I said,
I remember the name of that author, and that's a professional writer working today, and I won't name it.
No, I'm just saying. No, that's fine. The thing about The Lord of the Rings, and you and I talked about this once, and Baird Searles said this many times in that special he did on the poetry, the songs.
Songs and Poems of Middle Earth.
Oh, I still have that reel-to-reel tape somewhere.
Okay, if you do, I would like to take a look at it. My copy is fusing. The tape is actually fused. I have his Former Giles of Ham. And I have the Songs and Poems of Middle-earth, which, by the way, Baird is a voice on, but it was actually produced by his lover, Martin Last.
Really?
Yes.
I will say this. One of the things about the music that was done to the poems was that he used wonderful composers like Alan Hovhaness.
Yes.
He used, you know, other...
Well,
other...
these were people who hung out BAI. I met Hovhaness.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And he... like, for example, one of the pieces that is done is Hovhaness composing a suite of the Tower of Guard as Gandalf and Pippin are riding after Pippin has foolishly looked into the Palantir and he's seen
everything
eye
Pippin
in it.
Does. He's a fool of a Took.
Just as he was
a phrase that gets used several times.
Yeah, well, he used it in Moria when he dropped the stone into the well.
That's the first time, and the second time is in
Return of the King.
Is in Return of the King when he looks into the Palantir.
That's right. The thing that always
when Sauron assumes that Pippin is Frodo.
Right, and the thing that intrigued me was a continuance of generation. Here's what I mean: everybody in the trilogy is referred to, even the villains, as the son of someone. Frodo, son of Drogo.
Mm-hmm.
Aragorn, son of Arathorn. Denethor, son of Exthelion. My favorite, even Grima, Wormtongue. Grima, son of Gelmud.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a tradition. It's interesting, by the way.
Well, this is, as I mentioned to the first caller, because this is all based on Norse legend.
Yes. Now, it's interesting. I'm going to use a word I'm sure you've heard. There is a word in the Spanish tradition called hidalgo. And a hidalgo is actually a minor nobleman, a minor person of some note. That comes from the term hijo de algo. It means I'm the son of someone. And it was used during the Napoleonic War when Napoleon was redrawing the map of Europe. He made his brother king of Spain, and a lot of noblemen were running around trying to prove who they were, et cetera, et cetera. And the thing is that in Tolkien, there is this continuance of tradition that goes back, as you point out, and anyone wants to know what this sort of thing is like, all they have to do is read one Icelandic saga. And somewhere in that saga, whether it's Grettir, whether it's Njál, whether it's whatever, there is a 10-page section, which most people would find boring, I don't, of the entire lineage. And this is the son
of this. But you know what? This isn't – not only is this not confined to fantasy. I was watching a documentary that, despite the title, is brilliant, called She-Wolves of England.
Ooh.
About the various queens that ruled in their own right and were generally hated for it. And Eleanor of Aquitaine, her –
was the wife of Henry II.
Was it Matilda? After she was the wife of Louis. And she had 8 children altogether.
That's right.
3 of them for Louis, King of France. But the not that I know history, but I watched this yesterday. So anyhow, the point is Matilda. I mean, maybe yes. It was Matilda who was so
the mother of Henry II.
The point is that Matilda was so proud of her. I know what it is. Matilda is the empress.
Yes.
Because she was married
To the Holy Roman Emperor.
To the Holy Roman Emperor. And so even after the annulment and all that, she is still considered by some the empress. And her son, who was contending for the throne later, referred to himself as, I'm trying to remember the exact name, but it was basically, it came out to blank empress's son.
Yes, well,
Henry
was referred to as Henry Fitz Empress.
That's it. Thank you. Henry Fitz Empress. That's exactly
it. You know what Fitz is? Fitz is like saying you're born on the wrong side of the blanket without saying it. Fitz is a Norman patronymic way of saying...
But was in an old marriage.
Yeah, well, yeah, but it's a way of saying illegitimate. Just as in Hebrew, for example, there are two ways to say son of. Ben is proper, and bar, you say somebody bar somebody. It's saying he was on the, you know, whatever. But yeah, Henry always referred to himself, Henry Plantagenet, always referred to himself as Henry Fitz Empress.
Yeah. As opposed to from the male lineage.
Exactly.
But the point is that everybody always, especially on regal occasions, and this goes on to this very day, that when some royal person walks out to a given place, they will say, this person, son of that, king of that.
Yes.
Window shields wiper of the squeegees on First Avenue. All of their titles are pronounced at huge, great length.
Yeah, well, like I say, you know, but remember.
So it's not, all I'm saying is that when it comes up in fantasy books, and here's a very, very important thing about Tolkien that I've said very often through the years. Before Tolkien, fantasy was one kind of a thing. Fantasy was more affiliated with horror literature. It was H.P. Lovecraft. It was this, it was that. After Tolkien, everything changed. Everything changed. All fantasy, I would say pretty much all fantasy through the 80s, with very, very few exceptions, are all based on Tolkien, whether you're talking about the covenant of this person or that, if you're talking about the reworking of the Silmarillion, yeah. Not the Silmarillion, I'm sorry, help me, Catherine.
Oh, Kurtz.
Kurtz, yes.
Jeremy.
Yes. There we go. Yeah. And the Magdabinian.
Mabinogian, yes.
Thank you for saying it correctly.
Evangeline Walton, yes.
And that's who I was searching for. Evangeline Walton. Oh, wonderful books.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And
God bless Lynn Carter. He's a lousy writer, but he's a great editor.
Oh, he was a great editor, and he was quite the scholar. I once did a show with him and Lester Del Rey.
Oh, really?
And it was like lighting a match, pouring kerosene on something and running away. It was a wonderful show.
You know, the two great people who I met in various places, the two great, I would say scholars, but they were multidimensional. Lynn Carter and L. Sprague de Camp.
Sprague was one. Yeah, I had Sprague on the show a number of times. Oh, yeah.
I just finished.
Remember, I've been doing this since 1972.
Yeah, I know. You don't sound that old.
And Sprague and Lynn, I mean, it was almost hard to keep them off the air.
I recently reread it's a complete thing called The Mathematics of Magic, which was put out in 2007, and it's all the Fletcher Pratt and L. Sprague de Camp Harold Shea stories,
yeah.
Which, you know, you read them, and these were written in the 50s. They're still fun. They're still whimsically funny. And, of course, de Camp knew his – we talked once. and he knew his mythology, whether it was the Kalevala, whether it was Spenser's Fairy Queen, whether it was Ariosto.
And DeCamp was the person really responsible for bringing Conan the Barbarian
Absolutely.
Into the modern world,
yes.
and all this stuff. But the point that I was going to make is,
yes.
if you take a look at fantasy before Tolkien, okay. and you're looking at Clark Ashton Smith, yes. and you're looking at all these writers, that's one kind of fantasy. After Tolkien, everything changes.
And something, by the way, one book
and
I have
new fantasy only started emerging, I would say, in the last 20 years.
Well, in 1992, which was the 100th anniversary of his birth, a book came out called After the King, which was a you know what, a fest drift. Only the Germans could come up with a word like that. It's a eulogy.
No, the Germans would generally make it about 8 syllables long.
Oh, I thought that was the Welsh.
No, the Welsh do it without vowels.
Without vowels, I know. Anyway, but the After the King's a great collection. It's a tribute to Tolkien. One of the things about fantasy which I like in the last 20 years, as you point out, before, and I'm trying to think of his name, did a wonderful of Thud and Blunder. Poul Anderson did this wonderful thing of Thud and Blunder. And he basically pointed out that fantasy basically was a one-trick pony in where it was. Celtic, maybe English, Norse. But in the last 20 years, as you know, because you know authors, you know books, you've reviewed them, you've had them on the show, God love you for it, they have expanded to the point of view that I don't think there's a corner of the earth that hasn't been touched by writers, whether it's the Caribbean, whether it was Nola Hopkinson, whether it was... just any writer.
I will tell you major areas of culture that have yet to be dealt with science fiction or fantasy. Well, let's start with Asian, with the exception of Cordwainer Smith and a few other people. First of all of the Asian writers, Chinese specifically, there's a few Japanese, like
right.
Kobo Abe, but for the most part, Asian writers of the mythology and science fiction and fantasy are woefully lacking.
Yeah.
Although I must say I recently saw a movie that I had not heard of that I took great delight in called Detective D and the Phantom Flame. And if that sounds pulpy, well, it is. But let me tell you, this is a Hong Kong martial arts Chinese movie with CGI as good as any high-budget American film.
A lot of violence in it?
No.
Okay.
Actually, not that much, which is one of the reasons why a lot of the Chinese didn't care for it. But it was because all they're looking for in they're not looking for the storyline in a martial arts film any more than people like porn are looking for storylines. It's incidental to them. But the Judge D novels, it's Judge D in the novels and Detective D in the movie, there you get a lovely feeling of a different kind of culture. And when I mentioned this to Genevieve Valentine, she said, well, of course, Chinese cinema today is doing some of the best science fiction of all time. This was in a private email. And I wrote her back, if you're listening, Genevieve, I wrote her back and said, Genevieve, give me some titles. I need to see these movies. And I'm still waiting. If anybody listening can help me, but I must say that the genre of science fiction and fantasy, when it comes to Chinese traditions, one of them, and such a huge place, so many traditions, so many peoples that come from there. Where's Siberian lore? Where is any of this stuff in American stuff?
Let me ask you something. You mentioned an author to me once, Lily Wu, I believe.
Yes.
Is she doing anything in that realm?
Right now, she's busy getting her settling in Seattle, where she has a job. Lily is, first of all, she's American born.
Okay.
She's very young. She's an amazing writer. I have only read her one Nebula-nominated short story, but what she is original. To say that it comes from an Asian background is to say that it comes from her, but I would say the fact that she lived in rural New Jersey also was a great source.
There were some people who did occasionally a sort of a straying into Japanese tradition. I didn't think too much of her in terms of the plots, but Jessica Amanda Salmonson, way back, did two novels on an actual female samurai named Tomogozen. I checked this out with somebody. Yeah, she did that. I believe some people have done. Now, I will say this.
There are tales of Mulan. There are a few things here and there, but this has not become a part of the genre. Okay.
Yeah. The one place, and again, the one place where I think they've delved into it more is Eastern European to some extent. Charles de Lint did some stuff on Roma, gypsies.
There's a lot of Roma tales within science fiction and fantasy. Norman Spinrad did some.
There was an anthology actually called Under Future African Skies.
There's a reasonable amount of South American, but my point is, you said there are no cultures that haven't been incorporated.
I'll take that back.
And I would say there are huge gaps in culture not covered in science fiction fantasy. And
well,
one of the main reasons for that? Bad translations.
That's very true. Very true.
I mean, we only got a good translation of Roadside Picnic by Arkady and Boris Strugatsky. Boris Strugatsky died only about 3 months ago.
What's Roadside Picnic?
It's one of the great novels of science fiction ever, period, bar none.
Okay.
And was made into a movie called Stalker. Directed by Andrei Tarkovsky, who also did Solaris, and is one of the greatest directors of fantastic cinema ever. But Boris and Arkady Strugatsky wrote maybe 20 novels, great, great novels, and any number of short stories in science fiction. And here you go, and you're a Bissell scholar yourself, and you've never heard of the guy.
Well, listen.
And the reason for that, the reason you have never heard of him is a very simple one. The translations, either they're not done, or when they are done, they suck. So people read these bad translations and say, this isn't a good writer.
Well, that's why when you see an ancient classical work, such as say the Panchatantra or the Ramayana or the Mahabharata, you really have to check the background of the person doing it.
I don't need a good translation of the Ramayana. I've got Sita Sings the Blues.
I agree with you. Anyway, on that point, I'm going to bed.
Okay, have a
see
good
see you
night.
Next Tuesday.
Okay, very good. And, it's time for me to shut the bleep up and get off the air and make way for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister. Coming your way in just a couple of moments, let me again remind you to please, please come to the New York Review of Science Fiction readings this coming Tuesday, which is what Robert was referring to there, January 8th at Soho Gallery for Digital Art, 138 Sullivan Street. Admission is free. Terry McGarry and Veronica Shanus will be the readers, and they are not to be missed. For more information, visit my website, ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF, or if you are unfortunate enough to spend a lot of your time on Facebook, you can go to the Hour of the Wolf group on Facebook, or for that matter, to the New York Review of Science Fiction readings group, or just, you know, friend me. Please, somebody friend me. At any rate, thank you all for listening. Stay tuned to WBAI, wherever it may be, and let's hope for better times ahead. Be good to each other. Have a good morning.
I am as a toast. here. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the best. The red, white, and blue who spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torturing the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs lurk. Tell me I'm wrong, though that's my right, and it's right in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. The flag, I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what?
take a step and you'll drown.
Mike and I.